from Burbank, California, and Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Vice Presidents Being Number Two in the White House, the podcast, with Matt Sachs and Jason Klom. Hey, everybody, it's Jason Klom here with Matt Sachs in Minneapolis, Minnesota. How you doing, Matt?
I'm good. Thanks, Jason.
So this week, we are going to be talking about Aaron Burr. Figured we would get back on track with one of our favorites and probably the one we've studied the most out of necessity.
I think that's pretty accurate. Yeah, I mean, we've studied some other ones pretty heavily, but Burr just lends himself to so much study because such a fascinating, colorful life and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And a misunderstood one. I mean, well, okay. Misunderstood is not always the right... I don't want people to think necessarily that we're... that we take sides in the Burr issue, because people seem... But, you know, a little too much is of a devil is made of the man, to overuse a word that gets used in reference to him. We picked a guy who, again, you were saying we're not necessarily picking sides here, but that's because I think our view of history necessarily is their sides don't really make sense, at least in a historical perspective.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just that, you know, if history is a battle, then Hamilton and people who dislike Burr won the battle, in austerity, than over the Burr people, the Burrites, for what they were called back then in the days of the 1700s, 1800s. The Burrites have lost, and Hamiltonians and their supporters have won the case of history.
Yeah. I think we're going to start off with a little clip here. We'll do the first time I ever heard Aaron Burr's name, and probably for a lot of people in the country, if you weren't big on history as a kid, and I definitely wasn't, this might be the first time you ever heard Aaron Burr's name, and we'll discuss it a little here. I'm going to run the Got Milk commercial. I'm going to narrate it a little bit for you at home. There's a character actor putting peanut butter on a piece of bread.
And that was the Vienna Wood Dancing Bee, one of my all-time favorites.
Rob Paulsen.
And now let's make that random call with today's $10,000 question. It's a tough one. Who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel? All right, let's go to the phones and see who's out there.
He's in a museum dedicated to...
Hello? Hello, for $10,000. Who shot...
Aaron Burr.
Excuse me?
Aaron Burr. Oh, hold on, let me get some milk.
He doesn't have enough milk.
I'm afraid your time is almost up.
Aaron Burr.
I'm sorry, maybe next time.
Aaron Burr.
Aw, so sad.
Got milk.
And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, that is the original Got Milk ad also.
I think it's the first Got Milk ad.
Yeah.
I think it really is.
So, a few things about that. I tried to narrate over it, and that was a mistake. But that said, he's in a museum that's filled with the Burr-Hamilton stuff, including the bullet, which, okay. But it gets the point across. Telegraphing, as is the want of the director of that commercial, with whom Matt has worked. So I guess what I should say is that Aaron Burr's two most heinous acts were killing Alexander Hamilton and launching Michael Bay's career. So there we go.
Even more than the treason accusation, because he got off on that.
Mm-hmm.
Starting Michael Bay's career is probably an inexcusable kind of crime.
Yeah, it really is. But that's, you know, it's a cute commercial. It's got a great character actor, and I'm ashamed to not know his name, but I do know at the very least the guy on the radio is Rob Paulsen, also the voice of, you know, everybody. Raphael, the original Raphael Ninja Turtle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Great actor. Either way, yeah. So that's the kind of pop culture thing that he's relegated to is that one reference that he killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel. Sometimes even the word duel is left out, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's just that, like, they just say he murdered him, mm-hmm. and that's not the truth. Technically, legally, it's not the truth. They both agreed to it. It was a duel under the rules of Code Duello, and Both men agreed to the risks when it happened, so it was sanctioned, and it was, technically it was illegal in the state of New York, right. So it gets into muddy legal waters, but, you know, it was a mutually agreed decision by two gentlemen to fire at one another with loaded weapons, so...
And while that's not the most interesting thing of his life, really, obviously it's what everybody concentrates on. There are a lot of intricacies that you can go into. Maybe we'll discuss them in a little bit. But I think one of the reasons we're interested in him is that he is one of the less talked about founding fathers. Obviously, sure, he didn't draft, you know, any of the big documents, but he was there. Right. You know.
He didn't sign the Declaration. Mm-hmm. He didn't sign the Constitution. But what he did is pointed out by some people who were critics of Jefferson, while other people wrote documents, Burr was in the field. Mm-hmm. He went and fought battles. He was a young soldier. He was very young. He was only in his early 20s during the Revolution.
Right.
So he probably wouldn't have been elected to Congress, you know, anyway. He was considered like a boy by some people.
Right.
But he was a brave soldier.
I mean, he went to law school early, and there's some... what's crazy is that even going back as far as, you know, being a young, whatever, 16-year-old law student, the stories of, you know, supposedly bringing hookers onto campus with him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But, one could argue he could get away with it, given that his grandfather was founded Princeton?
Yes. Going back, I mean, Burr came from an old family and long legacy. His grandfather was Jonathan Edwards, who was considered one of the most foremost theologians in America. He wrote the famous book, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
Mm-hmm.
He founded Princeton, College of New Jersey, which became Princeton. And then his father was the first president of Princeton, and Burr never knew his father. He died, I think, when he was like 2 or 3 years old.
Right.
But he was a legacy, and he got into it very well because, you know, he was also brilliant, and he got into it as a young man and graduated with honors and everything. So he was a brilliant young man, and then he left studying the law to join the army. The Revolution.
Now, when we originally, in all of our studies, and we can talk about why we studied him so much more than the other VPs, other than him being fascinating in a minute, at the end of the day, do we know where he stood? No, that's right. That was his famous line on his deathbed when they asked him whether or not he believed in God. I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, he said, "I am coy. On that subject, I am coy."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So,
yeah, he was pretty much an atheist.
Yeah, he had to have been an atheist. I mean, at that, which I have to assume that at the time we always have this, and this is one of the things that I like about studying this stuff is that our lack of reverence, I think, kind of kills any bias we have, that people always assume because they revere these people so highly that they must have all been godly. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think you could be closeted anything back then as long as you kept it in the closet. And that goes for a lot of different things. And, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, Burr was a feminist.
Right.
Like, probably an atheist. I'm going to guess most likely an atheist. I'm going to say he was an atheist. He never attended church regularly or anything like that.
Right.
And he never adhered to religion or cited religion much.
Mm-hmm.
Literally on his deathbed, a reverend tried to get him to say that he believed in God and knew that God existed. And his last words were, "On that subject, I am coy." He wouldn't even do it on his literal deathbed, his last words.
Yeah. And it's fascinating, too, because I think his feminism comes from just where any of his other... We should talk about, too, why he was a feminist. I mean, he married an educated woman. He educated his own daughter. They had a very close relationship. There are always crazy rumors about it. But the only stuff you can prove is that he did educate his daughter. And they had a very close relationship. And he was, from all accounts, a good father. Unless you believe the BS scandal sheets.
Yes. Setting aside, like, the rumor mills and, you know, ridiculous, you know, that have no proof, there's no proof of any kind of scandal involved in his relationship. He was a loving, doting father, mm-hmm. a widower father.
Right.
He raised his daughter after his wife died. and raised her and educated her as he would a young man in that day and age. So she learned languages, and she learned music, and she learned how to ride a horse and shoot a gun while riding a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And she was probably the most sought after, you know, woman in all of the continent. She was beautiful and talented and brilliant.
I also wonder, too, if any of, and this is, I don't know if we explored this at all in, we can talk about, we have been writing for a while. We were going to do a documentary on Burr, then a miniseries. We still want to do a miniseries, but we're also working on a graphic novel that we did the outline of the story with, and it's now being fleshed out by Jack Finney, who lives in Minneapolis there as well. We want to do this graphic novel. But I have to wonder, too, if some of his open-mindedness, some of his feminism came out of utility, because he's the kind of guy who wouldn't tolerate stupidity. He doesn't strike. So he would need to be surrounded by smart people. So if he could choose a smart woman, he would. If he's going to raise a woman, she's going to be smart, too.
Right. I think it's partially that, but also it's just his own conclusions. I mean, he hung a picture of the writer and poet Mary Wollstonecraft above his mantle, married an older woman who was an accomplished, smart woman on her own.
Sure.
He wanted to raise his daughter that way. He had some quote, and I'm paraphrasing now, like, you know, I intend to prove with her that, you know, a woman can think for herself or something like that when it came to his daughter being born.
Right.
I mean, he just was an intelligent, open man. You know, he introduced the first bill to abolish slavery in the New York legislature when he was a New York state senator.
See, and that's one of those things I don't even remember from studying, because there's so much that went on. I you forget the, again, they seems, it's obviously nothing small, but it's gone by the wayside because of a bunch of personal stuff. I mean, this duel is a personal issue. The treason, maybe not. The potential treason that he was, by the way, acquitted of.
Yes. The duel and the treason trial overshadow everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no getting around it. The duel and the treason trial cover everything else about the man in a shadow.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, because he had a lot of great accomplishments. He was a war hero. He fought bravely in battles, horrible battles in the Revolution. The invasion of Quebec, where he was immortalized in a painting and cited for courage and everything,
mm-hmm.
When he was about 19, in the Battle of Monmouth, where he suffered from a heat stroke and had a horse fall on him.
Jesus.
And nearly kill him. He served in Valley Forge. He guarded the most vulnerable part of Valley Forge and trained men there in the horrible winter of Valley Forge. And even after he left the army for health reasons, he managed to organize students and civilians and defend Princeton when it was invaded by the British.
It's crazy.
Saved a whole battalion. At one point, he saved a whole battalion of troops during the evacuation of New York. He saved a whole battalion of troops because he knew the layout of the land and how to guide them. And ironically, Alexander Hamilton was in that battalion that he saved.
Yeah, and I think even my own, in studying him originally, I feel like my own perspective on him was always skewed, and it's going to be unavoidably a little bit skewed. I wanted to look at it when studying it. I want to be like as open-minded as possible, but there's still always, because not even, disregard the duel, because the duel, I think, is a personal issue, and it was two guys, regardless of who insisted, they both participated, they both played the game, and there are also plenty of rumors, and, well, not rumors, Hamilton had hair triggers put in, both the guns had hair triggers, and Hamilton picked them, but the treason was the one thing that I felt was an undeniable, like, oh, well, he was a bad guy, but, like, at the end of the day, it's big, it's gigantic, and it's something he would have been killed for. He would have been executed if he had been convicted. But A, there wasn't enough evidence, and B, he'd gone through a lot of crap. That doesn't excuse it. But it's this one thing that I think that is the result of a guy who really did, like it or not, love America. And America was not, also, this is the other perspective thing too, is America wasn't then what it is now. They didn't have to have any crazy nostalgia about hundreds of years ago, because there was no hundreds of years ago. It was a new thing. They're like, well, maybe this isn't going to work. You know?
Right. Well, they were basically modeling America over the Roman Republic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what all the founders wanted to be compared to. They wanted to be compared to the great legendary Romans. Like, Washington was Cincinnatus, the farmer soldier who went back to the farm. And other founders were other famous Romans, you know, who were famous senators and noble members of the Republic. That's what they were looking to. Because there was no model, he said.
And everybody needs a Brutus, I guess.
Well, or what Burr was commonly called, Catiline.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
Notorious as a traitor and a usurper and a pervert.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so
that's what Burr was always ascribed to. Other founders weren't as ambitious or progressive as Burr.
Mm-hmm.
And Burr was ambitious and progressive. He didn't do the whole disinterested politics thing of, like, not campaigning. He organized people. He worked to try and get people elected and get himself elected. And this was considered in poor taste and gauche.
Right.
And not becoming of a statesman.
And people often who are that impassioned become, or at the very least are at their hearts, love it or leave it, they're anarchists. And I won't go so far as to call him an anarchist, but when you feel that strongly and then everything you've worked for doesn't work out the way you want, you can almost understand his motivations for wanting to take over Mexico and then invade the U.S. and kill Jefferson and be like, nope, this is how I want it to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if anarchist is the right term. I think he was a purely a Democrat. I mean, what he wanted to do was, you know, he believed that citizenship should come with immigrants. He wanted immigrants to be citizens.
Mm-hmm.
He established, like, a bank and water company so that they could, you know, invest and have bank accounts and have money and register them to vote. He made the Tammany Hall Society, which was like a club, into a political group. He wanted people to have rights and to be able to vote. Women and all immigrants, and even, you know, and he wanted to abolish slavery, you know, at points in his life.
Right.
So I think he was a true believer in the Democratic Republic that he stood for, that it was his party's name, a Democratic Republican.
And the irony, of course, is that he is in so many situations either a footnote or a misunderstood piece of history when he was almost president. And he tied with Jefferson. People don't, in the election of 1804, the two of them tied. And then, or I'm sorry, was 1800? Sorry, 1804 was the, right. So 1800 is when they tied. And I mean, that's just it. They tied. And then there are a number of rumors. Gore Vidal, who we interviewed about it, has his own theories of how it went and exactly why it went the way it did. But of course, you know, as we all know, Jefferson became president. But Jefferson, it's just that weird situation that obviously doesn't exist anymore, where the loser was VP. So.
Well, I mean, whoever came in second was VP. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but in the case of Jefferson and Burr, you know, they had kind of agreed run together for the first time, and with the understanding that Jefferson was going to be president and Burr would be vice president. And then after two terms, Jefferson, you know, would step aside in the Washington tradition and Burr would become president.
Right.
In exchange, Jefferson agreed to all this in exchange for the New York electoral votes that Burr controlled, because he had both Democratic, Republican, and Federalist support there.
Mm-hmm.
So without Burr, Jefferson couldn't have been elected president.
Right.
Period.
Right. Should we talk, should I run a little clip of Gore talking about Hamilton, or are we not ready for Hamilton yet? What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, I think we can do that because, like, you know, we talked about Burr's war record and, you know, he organized and made politics in New York what they were, and he became the most powerful politician in New York, as well as an accomplished attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the election of 1800, that's where a lot came to fruition, and this is where we get into, like, his relationship with Hamilton. So I think this is a good point for that.
Sounds good. All right, let's run that real quick.
Alexander Hamilton enters the scene, telling libels about him. Hamilton was always ran off at the mouth, and though he was a very brilliant man, he was a rather vicious one. And he's the only person that Burr ever lost his cool with. Whatever it was he said about him, I have my theories, but they're only theories. Burr called him out for a duel. He had written in a paper that I have worse things to say of Colonel Burr than so far I have, far worse than the public ever will know. And Burr said, meet me at Weehawken.
All right, so I'm going to end it on his line, meet me at Weehawken, because it's just so, he's such a dramatist. I love it. It's so brilliant. Meet me at Weehawken.
It's an epic line.
Yeah.
It's an epic line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So,
boy.
Yeah. When we talk about Burr and Hamilton, it's always in reference to the duel, but they'd known each other for decades at that point.
Right.
They both served in the Revolution together. They'd met during that time when they were young men. They, like I said, Burr saved Hamilton. He saved Hamilton's life and saved Hamilton from being captured during like the evacuation of New York. They both had been at Valley Forge together.
Right.
And of course, and as revealed in what some people don't know is they conducted a famous murder trial together as lawyers. They worked together as lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
They conduct a famous murder trial together as joint representatives in a book. There was a good book about it recently called Duel with the Devil, where it talks about Burr and Hamilton working together in this famous murder trial.
Yeah. And that's
so they had friendly relations.
And you know, it's easy to to condense. I mean, you know, Gore's got to do what he can. I mean, he wrote a whole, you know, historical novel on the situation. But I mean, there's, you know, it's easy, like I said, it's easy to condense the whole thing into just this duel. But the hardest part is we still don't know exactly, other than this press war that they had back and forth, we don't know exactly what was said. And as Burr said, or as Gore said, I have my theories. It's just,
yeah. Well, I mean, we have the letters and the correspondence building up to the duel.
Sure.
We have that correspondence, thank God. It's
right.
Great that stuff wasn't. What we don't know is what, like, we know what, like, was published in the paper that started the whole exchange of letters. What we don't know is what might have been said privately that wasn't published.
Right. It was a classic Twitter feud, and it.
It was. And that's interesting you say that, because Lin-Manuel Miranda, in his interview about Hamilton on CBS, said, Hamilton would have sucked at Twitter. He would have always been like getting, you know, replying to people and getting into flame wars and everything.
100%, right.
And that's the kind of person Hamilton was.
Yeah.
If he just couldn't walk back on stuff.
Right.
And when he said he had I have a worse opinion of Colonel Burr, you know, and called him despicable, that's what really set it off.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too, that there's a big separation in terms of language. Like you said, the term Catiline, not something most people said. Like, obviously my point of reference was totally off. It was the first thing I could think of, but Catiline's not, but just to say despicable, like the weight that would have had at the time is not translatable.
Well, yeah, despicable was a term that was used for personal habits, not like political habits.
Right.
And this is where, again, we get into the semantics of the day. You know, a man's politics were separate from his personal life is what it was considered then.
Sure.
You didn't mix the personal with the politics. I mean, Hamilton, by the point of the duel, he'd fallen out of power. Mm-hmm. He'd already had his own scandals because he'd been having an affair with a married woman. And all the letters and correspondence had been revealed because they blackmailed him with it. Mm-hmm. The couple, the wife and the husband who he'd had the affair with.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did he do? He published a book about it defending himself. Like an idiot.
God.
And probably the second stupidest thing he ever did, the first stupidest thing he did was accept the duel. The second stupidest thing he did was publish that book about his affair.
Mm-hmm.
It basically ended his public life. He was ineffectual. After that.
And the $10 bill, I guess, wipes that all out for most people.
Well,
you know.
Yeah. I mean, we put a halo on Hamilton and Burr gets the devil's horn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know this is just how it is.
How do you think, and I'm not a big fan of what would have happened kind of conjecture, but had it gone the other way, I mean, was Hamilton out of favor? Was he out of favor enough that if he killed Burr, that it would have gone the same way? Because I have to wonder, because one was definitely more out of favor than the other, but one of them also had Burr might have had the political acumen to pull himself out of it. I don't know.
That's a really tough question.
Yeah.
Obviously, killing a person, even in a duel, would have resulted in a scandal automatically in certain parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Southerners didn't have a way. They were fine with it. They considered it a question of honor.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the consensus from, like, Southern congressmen and senators about the duel, even Federalist ones were like, well, it's a shame Hamilton was killed, but this was a question of honor.
Right.
And two men met on the field of battle, and that's how it goes.
I think I said, by the way, I need to correct myself. I think I said Burr would have had the political acumen. I meant Hamilton. I wonder if he would.
Oh, Hamilton.
Yeah, sorry, because obviously Hamilton died. I meant it the other way, the other way around, because obviously.
Sure.
Yeah. If Hamilton had killed Burr, would he have had the he had it at some point. Would he have been able to pull himself out of it?
God, it's a hard question to answer for me personally, I think, because, I mean, Burr, if he'd killed Burr, Burr was the vice president of the United States.
Sure, that is true, right.
So it would have been huge. It would have been, you know, it would have obviously been huge either way.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the duel, Burr was the vice president of the United States, and Hamilton held the highest position in the army, the equivalent of the Joint Chief of Staff today.
Right.
So this would be as if, like, you know, if you want to go back, like, if Dan Quayle had shot Colin Powell.
Sorry, I'm just picturing that. That's fascinating.
I know. But that's the equivalent of what it was. Yeah. The vice president of the United States killed the highest ranking officer in the American military, which was what Hamilton occupied at that time as a military officer. And Hamilton was brilliant, so he might have been able to get his way out. Plus, he'd written all those letters saying that he intended to throw away his shot, that he didn't believe in dueling, that he'd set himself up. That's the other thing about Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
He was clever enough, and I'm going to use the word devious enough, to set himself up so that he'd look either way like a winner. And he came out, he lost the duel, but he came out the posterity history winner because everyone in his letters, cite his letters, like, oh, no, he said he was going to throw away his shot. And he said he didn't believe in dueling. And he tried, and on his own deathbed, he, unlike Burr, who stuck to his convictions when a minister, priest asked him to admit that there was a God, Hamilton begged for, on his deathbed, begged for communion and absolution.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And was later called a religious man when he'd ever attended church regularly.
Yeah, it's perfect, and I'm always curious too what sort of political forces were behind that painting, but maybe it was just him. But what's crazy is that at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, Hamilton knew the guns well; they were his guns. His son had used them in a duel the year before, and they had hair triggers, and he knew it, and Burr didn't.
Yes, there can be no denying this, and this is where I get kind of infuriated with Hamilton apologists. This is where I will kind of like get in their face and go, you can't deny this. One, Hamilton knew the guns. His son had used them the year before and been killed with them at the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they were special customized dueling pistols that had the hair trigger, where if you knew they had the hair trigger and you pulled the trigger, it took less pressure to fire than if you didn't. You could fire your shot faster.
Mm-hmm.
It gave you an advantage. Hamilton had to have known this, obviously, and there is no way that Burr could have known it.
Right.
No. Three, at the duel, Hamilton put on his glasses, sighted some shots, like he pointed off the gun a few other places to like test it and see, you know, to get his aim down. He made a big show of putting on his glasses and practicing, you know, and everything before he said that he was ready. So if he was going to throw away his shot.
Yeah, that's quite a show to put on.
Yeah, and he didn't like just point up straight in the air and fire, which he could have done. He aimed in the general direction of Burr, and the shots were separated by just a few seconds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hamilton second said that Burr fired first, which, no, Burr's second said that he fired, that Hamilton fired first. It's more like, it's most likely, and most people agree on this. Joseph Ellis, other historians mostly agree that Hamilton fired first and probably did throw away his shot in the sense that he aimed high because his shot went and hit a tree branch hanging high over and behind Burr.
Mm-hmm.
But Burr had every right to fire, and Burr had no idea he was going to do that.
Right.
How was he supposed to know? The guy had put on his glasses and practiced aiming before he did it, seconds before he shot.
I think that's a good introduction into this clip. That I'm going to run the clip, and then we'll talk about what this clip is from, because it's kind of awesome. All right, let's run this clip. And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry. And I'm not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Now that kind of you, it's undeniably exciting. That's some good stuff. That is from Hamilton the musical.
Yes.
And you pointed me to this because you follow theater more than I do, of course. So what do you know about the show? Because I only know that really is that song, and it's great.
Sure. It's great. No, Hamilton the musical is based on Ron Chernow's huge, massive biography on Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who won the Tony for his musical In the Heights.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote and created it and starred in it. And it was at the Public Theater in New York, and now it's moved to Broadway, or it's moving to Broadway. He basically read Chernow's massive book on Hamilton like when he was on vacation and was like, why hasn't this been to a musical? And he decided to make it into a musical, and it's in hip-hop. It's done in a hip-hop style. It reflects today's America in the diverse casting.
Mm-hmm.
Manuel Miranda is Puerto Rican descent, and he plays Hamilton. The actor Leslie Odom Jr., who's an African-American, a black man, he plays Aaron Burr. It's very diverse.
Yeah, and if you search for that, I just played that off of YouTube, so you can see that clip on YouTube if you just search for Hamilton the musical. It's just a quick trailer, which rarely do you ever get to see that kind of thing for something on Broadway, but obviously because of the subject matter, I'm excited. And it looks to me, and again, I have very little information to go off of, it doesn't look like... I mean, you can tell just from the look on his face that he's not playing Hamilton as any... it looks to be a factual performance. He looks kind of tortured the way he's playing it. Like, I'm just going off of that one clip, but he's an intense dude.
Yeah, no, he plays it all. I mean, there's scenes like, you know, in the musical, there's scenes where he debates Jefferson, and it's done like a rap battle, like imagine like an 8 Mile
that's sort awesome.
Of style.
That's awesome.
It's awesome. It's awesome. There's, you know, he doesn't shy away from the controversy, like Hamilton's, you know, affair with the woman, a married woman when he was married, mm-hmm. you know, cheating on his wife. He doesn't shy away from the flaws that Hamilton had, his temper, his need to always get in the last word, his infidelities. I've read an amazing interview with him, Manuel Miranda, in the New Yorker, where he talked about the creation of the musical and the structure of it, and you know how fascinated he was with it. And what's interesting is in the interview, I remember him saying like he was torn about should I play Hamilton or should I play Burr.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, in the CBS Sunday Morning interview that he did, I think he was wearing a shirt that said Burr fired first or something like that. I've seen him wearing a shirt that said Burr fired first, and I'm like, no, you're wrong.
That's funny.
You're wrong about that, sir.
It's great to have, you know, this kind of pop culture agreement with our perspective, in the very least that these are interesting people. Even if, again, Alexander Hamilton was not a VP, at least it surrounds one of the stories we're so fascinated with.
Oh, yeah, well, Burr is a major character in the show. Mm-hmm. Major character in the show. And what's exciting to me is what you said. Like, this show is getting great reviews mm-hmm. from everyone, from, like, David Brooks to all the theater critics in New York. To, you know, Ron Chernow is thrilled with it. He's very happy about it.
Oh, good. That's awesome. He loves it.
Yeah, I mean, he was hesitant at first. And then, you know, Miranda met with him and brought him into rehearsals and made him a part of the process of the creation of the show. He loves it.
Mm-hmm.
People love this show.
Yeah.
It's a hit. Critically and artistically, it's a hit. And I'm going to go on and say, like, I think it's the favorite for the Tony for Best New Musical, whether it's eligible this year, 2015, or next year, 2016,
mm-hmm.
I think it should win. I think it's the favorite right now, and I think it should win one without even seeing it, just seeing the clips.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the most innovative, interesting musical that's come around.
Well, that's just the thing, too, is quite frankly, it's the approachability of it, is that hip-hop makes it, it adds a flavor to it that you wouldn't expect and is going to make more people look into this. And you can't discount that on it, you know, on its face.
No, you can't. I think it's a smart choice. I think it's, I admit, at first I was like, hip hop, really?
Right.
Okay. And then I watched clips from it and I read the interviews and I thought about it more and I'm like, I'm going to open myself up to this experience. I'm going to open myself up to it and be open-minded and give it a chance. And from everything I've seen, it looks amazing. And it sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm excited to see it if I ever get the opportunity to.
I'm somehow going to see it. As soon as they record the soundtrack and make it available, I'm going to buy it. I wish I could go to New York and see it. I have a friend in New York who I think is going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's posted about trying to get tickets for it. It's hard to get tickets for it. It's almost impossible to get tickets for it. It's so popular.
I'm sure, yeah.
Which is mind-blowing.
Yeah. No, it's great. When's the last time, was it Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson? Is that the last time anybody, you know, paid attention to something like this?
Well, I would say the more accurate thing would be 1776, you know.
Oh, true.
1968-69.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a musical about the founding fathers writing the Declaration of Independence with, you know, John Adams and Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson
mm-hmm.
and other minor, you know, the signers, all the signers there being played on stage, you mm-hmm. know. People as obscure as Josiah Bartlett, who was the basis for the character in West Wing, his name anyway.
Right.
For people like Edward Rutledge to Caesar Rodney, all these obscure people who signed the Declaration of Independence, you know, that show made an effort. Every single one of them has a line and has a moment mm-hmm. in it. Watch that show, which is a musical I've seen a million times and love.
I think
go ahead. Hamilton since.
Go ahead. We got a bad connection. Go ahead.
I just said, there's been nothing like Hamilton since 1776 to me.
No, that makes sense. That's probably a more apt comparison. And I think, again, it's one of those, the reason we picked, not just picked Aaron Burr, obviously we want to do a documentary about every VP who never became president and the reasons for it. And, you know, some of them are tragedies, some of them maybe are good things that they never became president. But at the end of the day, the reason this one's so interesting is because it feels mispainted by history, because you can't deny that he did some bad things, and you can maybe assume he was a bad man, but like, if our perspective, and I think the perspective of the documentary and anything else that we make of this, is that you know, we're far removed enough from it to really not judge. And if you don't revere them and you don't judge them, you get this much more rich picture of history.
Yes. Now, I think we need to look at the founders as not, and you know, as not like shining ivory statues on a hill,
mm-hmm.
but as men who had their positive attributes and negative attributes.
Mm-hmm.
They were men, and Burr was no more flawed than any of them.
Right,
as heroic as any of them as well, and definitely more progressive than most of them.
He just was really bad at playing with the system sometimes, at least when it came to the treason trial. Because that's just one of those things that just stands out. Now, to be fair, do we know if there weren't other people trying to do the exact same thing? No, we don't. But he is the one shining example.
Yes, and keep in mind, in the treason trial, the main witness against him was in reality one of the worst traitors in American history.
Mm-hmm.
General James Wilkinson, who was the person who alerted President Jefferson to the conspiracy of it, was a paid agent of the Spanish crown.
That's right.
And we know that. We have paperwork showing that he, like, signed a loyalty oath to the King of Spain and spied for Spain. While he was the highest ranking officer in the American military, he was in the pocket of the King of Spain and defended Spanish interests over American interests here in the continent of North America. He was a horrible traitor. Teddy Roosevelt said he was one of the most despicable people in American history.
That's interesting.
And that was the main witness for Burr at his treason trial. And the only reason, and one of the only reasons he even got exposed for doing what he was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've, at the very least, given a basic primer of some of the really good things that Burr did for the country, or at the very least, like, some interesting good human traits that he displayed. And I think, you know, people should go out and read whatever you can find about him, but also just keep an eye out, because, like I said, we're working on a graphic novel about him.
Yes.
We do not have a projected date for that yet, right? I mean, I don't know. I could be wrong on that. But
it's a long process, writing something like this, because we want it to be accurate and entertaining.
Mm-hmm. That's the hardest part. There's so much. It's so dense.
It is. I mean, there's so much richness to his life and so many unique traits to him. You know, President Woodrow Wilson, who was the president of Princeton before he became president of the United States, you know, wrote about Burr and said, you know, that he was a man who was, I'm trying to remember this exactly right. I'm probably not going to get it right, but he was, you know, Burr had genius enough to make him immortal and passion enough to make him infamous.
Mm-hmm.
He was a multi-layered man who had all sorts of interesting and positive traits like that we talked about. He was a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
In a time when feminism wasn't an idea that was even conceived of, practically.
Right.
He believed in immigration and immigrants' rights, and that immigrants should become citizens in the United States quickly. He wanted to abolish slavery. He was a military hero, a brilliant lawyer, a public servant who served in the Senate, a great senator, and a vice president of the United States. And he was a loving husband and father. He had flaws. After his wife died, he slept with a lot of prostitutes.
Sure.
No denying. He slept with a lot of them and wrote ratings of them and sent those ratings back to his daughter. It's weird, but it was what it was. But he was as much a founder that we should revere as any of the other ones. And also that we should look at objectively, too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more to him than the duel and the treason. And I think that's something that people should, if you look into his life, and there's so much fascinating stuff about him, I think you get a lot from reading and learning about Burr. He represents America just as much as any of the founders.
Yeah.
And he's a part of our history. And you can't just shove him off into a corner and call him, you know, an enigma or a riddle or, you know, a devious planner.
Yeah.
You can't dismiss him.
No. And I think his motivations were mostly pretty clear, actually. He's pretty obvious what he was trying to do in most cases. And, you know, you know deep down a lot of those things were motivated by good, whether he did, maybe not the sleeping with the hookers part, but, you know, the rest of it is pretty well motivated. If you're going to paint a character, most of the things he did had pretty clear-cut reasons behind them.
Yeah, he never hid the fact that he said things like, you know, it is my intention to make business my pleasure and pleasure my business.
Mm-hmm.
And in regards to the law, he said, oh, the law is just something that you can, you know, boldly assert and plausibly maintain. You know, he was very quippy
Yeah, and there are a few really overused quotes that I can't remember them right now, unfortunately, that are actually, if you go back, are actually attributable to Burr, because he was just a brilliant guy and a good speaker, et cetera, et cetera. Didn't he make, when he left the Senate, didn't he make everybody weep, basically?
Yeah. I think this is a good place to end on.
Mm-hmm.
After the duel and everything, he was still vice president of the United States after the duel. And he had to preside over the impeachment trial of a Supreme Court justice, Samuel Chase. And he presided over it brilliantly. And there were lots of quotes by Federalist opponents of his who said, Vice President Burr is doing an incredible job running this trial. He is doing it brilliantly. He's one of the most ablest administrators I've ever seen. He did it exactly what he needed to do in that treason trial. Or not treason trial, I'm sorry. Impeachment. He wasn't going to let Jefferson steamroll Justice Chase. But he did want to put Justice Chase, who was out of line and a bully and a jerk, in his place. And he did both. He chastised and shamed the judge, but he didn't let him get impeached and let Jefferson railroad the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. He kept the executive branch separate from the judicial branch in a brilliant way. He did a great job. And then after that, he gave a farewell speech to the Senate. And it's unfortunate that no one has the exact transcript of it. It all wasn't written down. But quotes from it, if you read them, are just beautiful. Mm-hmm. About, you know, the Senate being the last bastion of American democracy, and that if ever a dictator or a demagogue tries to take over the United States, it will be the Senate where he will be defeated. Mm-hmm. And it'll be the last stand of American democracy. And the parts that are preserved are beautiful and patriotic and noble in defending America and our Constitution. And it was such a great speech, and he delivered it in such a wonderful way. That you're right. What he did was, he did it maybe the first classic drop the mic kind of moment in history. Where after it was done, he just walked up the middle of the aisle of the Senate, walked out the door, shut it behind him, and left everyone just sitting there kind of stunned. And people burst into tears and cried. There were senators who couldn't get up from their chairs for 20, 30 minutes after hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a speech that just lit up the country. It was so beautiful and moving.
So good.
And it was amazing. And it's a shame that there's no real 100% transcript of it, because when you read the sections that we do have, it's brilliant. And that was Aaron Burr, too. He was a patriot. He was as much a patriot as any American.
Well, I would say if you can't read the comic book right now, which isn't out yet, if you can't see our miniseries about him yet, since Vice Presidency documentary is not completed yet, why don't you go out, if you're in New York, go see Hamilton the Musical, and just tell us how it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Go see Hamilton. And I want to give a shout-out to Leslie Odom Jr., the actor who's playing Burr in the show right now, who has, favorited some tweets I've sent. In regards to the show, and has requested that we send him a link to this podcast. So I want to say break a leg, and congratulations to the entire cast of Hamilton, and especially Mr. Leslie Odom Jr. On his role as Aaron Burr. I think he's doing him proud.
Absolutely, and I think we should just close with Hamilton shot first.
Yes, Hamilton shot first!
Vice Presidents Being Number 2 in the White House is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. Please visit stolendress.com for our other podcasts, blogs, and videos. You can follow Vice Presidents on Facebook and Twitter / Vice Presidents.